emailed yesterday, I don't know how many of you have seen it, basically having to do with any of you who might be interested in pursuing a PhD in sociology, you know, as if this wasn't enough fun already, that you might want to make a career out of this, or at least go further. And we're entering into the period for the next month or so where applications need to be put together and so forth. And if you haven't checked your email since yesterday afternoon, you will not have seen this message. But in any case, the idea here is there are bursaries and other sources of funding that are available for doing PhDs. And in fact, there's a £1,000 fellowship for alumni of Warwick. That is to say, what you people will become if you're in your third year and about to graduate. So anyone, I mean, in a sense, my comments here are addressed to those of you primarily in your third year. What you need, and there are other sources of funding, including the ESRC, which is the main social science funding body in this country. And there are also fellowships that the university gives. The key thing here, two points, and by the way, other lecturers in this department may have already told you something about this. You will probably be hearing this again from other people. I'm saying it here because those of you who are interested in working in the topics that are covered in these lectures, in this course, should talk to me. Because one of the things that you need is you need a faculty sponsor or supervisor. And that is to say someone who would be willing to supervise your research. So you want to find someone whose interests are similar to yours. That's a very important point. You really can't get off the ground unless you've got that, okay? The other point is that you need, your overall degree class needs to be at least a 2-1. Now, nowadays, that's like half the people who graduate, so I don't know if that's such a problem anymore. But the point is, 2-1 is the bare minimum. If you get lower than a 2-1, of course you can do PhDs, but you probably wouldn't be very competitive from a funding standpoint. And what we're talking about here is funding. Right? Because you can apply to do a PhD if you're willing to fund yourself at any time, and we'll take you at any time you can pay. You know, assuming you have basic literacy skills and things of that kind. But if you want to actually get, you know, some funding, that is competitive, and that is based very much on academic merit. All right? And the period that we're talking about, so February and March are where the relevant deadlines are. You will probably be hearing stuff about this from other lecturers as well. We were just notified about this late last week. Okay, so just keep that in the back of your mind if you're thinking about it, because you will have to file an application in the next few weeks, that is to say before the end of this term. That will mean, among other things, you will need to think of who might write references for you, and for example, you know, if you're in this course and you're interested in stuff that I'm doing, I could write a reference for you, for example, I could be one of them. And the same is true of other lecturers as well. Also, you will need to come up with some sense of what your topic might be. And the way this typically works is your first year is a kind of master's. You get a master's at the end of the first year where you're primarily being taught research methods of a wide variety. And then you have 3 years after that to do the PhD. That's the way it typically works. Okay? All right. Now, there are, of course, part-time PhD students as well who kind of pay their way and take, you know, twice the time maybe. That's possible too. But what I'm talking about here are people who want to get funding to do PhD. Okay? All right, so that's one announcement out of the way. Now, the next thing I want to talk about, which is related to the topic of the lecture today, which is going to be on religion and evolution, and we're gradually moving into a segment where we're going to start to talk about science. So I probably won't say everything I want to say about evolution today. But we're kind of moving in that direction. We're going to move from religion into science as forms of knowledge. And one issue that came up, and I tried to address this in an email that I sent last week with regard to the readings for this previous seminar, was the business of a sociologically coherent category. That is mentioned in the first assessed essay question. Okay? And I believe I have religion, the university, and science. Are these sociologically coherent categories? Now, this point is particularly relevant for this topic, religion, okay, which I would argue, and I argue this in the knowledge book, is not a sociologically coherent category. Now, generally speaking, what we mean by sociologically coherent category is that the things that fall under the category have quite a lot in common. Okay. Now, when something sociologically incoherent, What that typically means is they're defined more in terms of what they're not than what they are. You know this, you may have heard of this phrase, my enemy's enemy is my friend. Okay? Well, that's like sociological incoherence, right? Where basically what all of these various things that fall under a category have in common is that they are not something else. So, for example, in the case of religion, the reason why one might want to argue that it's not sociologically coherent is because the things that we normally call religion, and I'm talking about the world religions, so I'm talking about Judaism, Christianity, Islam, the monotheistic religions, but I'm also talking about Hinduism, Buddhism, Confucianism, Taoism, right, Shintoism, Sikhism, all these other things, the world religions, right, what they have in common, and this has a lot to do with the way this term religion gets used as a sociological category starting in the 19th century, is that they maintain social relations over great expanses of space and time without the modern nation state. Okay? All of these formations that we call religion, right, do you might say, state-like activities, but without the state. And that's why, historically, all of them have been in some kind of conflict with states. I mean, one of the ways I talk about it in the knowledge book, which I think is pretty useful, is that in a sense they're sort of like the original non-governmental organizations. Right? I mean, if you think about what NGOs are, right, they're often providing a lot of the things that states are supposed to be providing, but the states, you know, aren't strong enough or, you know, whatever. There are all sorts of problems, so that as a result, welfare cannot be provided for, security cannot be provided for, and so forth. But historically, religions have done this kind of function too. Okay, so for example, before we had the welfare state, before there was socialism, it was quite common for churches to be, you might say, the major sort of source of charity. And indeed, this word charity, right, is a word that comes from Christian theology. Okay, and it means love. And so in terms of who was historically responsible for the poor and so forth, the church was. So the church performed welfare functions. This is not just true of Christianity, it's true of all the major religions that actually had some kind of social presence. That's to say that they had churches or monasteries or, you know, something of that kind, had some kind of physical social presence. So they did a lot of state-like functions, but they didn't need the state to do it. Okay. And it was under those circumstances. Now you see, the reason why this category of religion gets invented in the 19th century is of course because you're seeing the rise of the modern nation state. Right? And sociology as a discipline, if you think about, you know, especially people like Durkheim and Weber, much more so than Marx, right? The state is very pivotal to how society is defined. Right? There's a sense in which what is society, understood in this kind of singular sense, well, it's basically people who live within the borders of a nation state. Right? So we talk about the educational system, the economic system, right? We talk about all these different systems, social systems in society, but what is the boundary of the society to which these various systems apply? Well, it's pretty clearly the state, right? Just geographically bounded unit that has, you know, a certain uniform political governance. So, when one talks about society in the sense of the state, one thinks about things like, you know, that there is a common language, right? That there is a tax base, right? So that revenue is collected from throughout the region and then brought to some central place and somehow redistributed. Okay? There's a common educational system. Now, if you look at the history of the development of the state, the way in which the state typically accrues power and sets its boundaries as being the governor of society is by taking power from the church, from the religions. I mean, and this is, if you want, you know, in terms of where it's really very strong is in the case of education, where if you were to look at Europe let's say, before and after 1870, after good years, 1870, you would see that before 1870, most educational provision in Europe was religious. Okay. You know, faith-based, as we call it nowadays. But after 1870, most of it became secular. And very often what happened was there was actually the appropriation of church property, you know, so that the formerly religious schools became state schools. There was sometimes that kind of direct transfer that took place. Okay? Now, generally speaking, you know, one of the interesting things, and if you know, this is something always interesting to do from a kind of comparative historical standpoint, is the degree to which the church has a special status within the secular state. So, for example, can it be taxed? Right? Can it be subject to the sort of auditing procedures that the rest of society can be? And obviously, states differ tremendously across the world on this point. Okay? So the point here is that religion is basically a category that was initially defined negatively in terms of the maintenance of social relations of a very substantial kind, you know, through, you know, the various sorts of ways in which social relations are maintained, not just in a superficial way like being a member of a club, but rather very deep kind of social relations that would cover the maintenance of people's security and education and all these things that we normally associate with the state, right? The religions were in fact doing this kind of thing, right? But without the nation state, and indeed sometimes in competition with the nation state. Okay. Now the word religion itself, as the term for all these things, really refers primarily to the ritualistic aspect of religion. So, you know, how do you know you're in a particular religion? Right? If you wanted to think about it from a sociological standpoint, how do you know somebody's in a religion? Well, it's by the things they do, the rituals they perform. That's the clearest way to distinguish religions, okay, is in terms of their rituals. So, for example, if you look at Christianity, is a very good case in point for this kind of issue, because, as you know, Christians, in a general kind of way, all believe in the Bible, Old and New Testament, right? And there's quite, you know, broad degree of agreement on a lot of doctrinal matters within Christianity. But the way they interpret it is really quite different. And it's especially different at the level of the ritual. And ritual needs to be understood in this very broad sense. Namely, how do you conduct your life? Right? The way in which a Catholic conducts his or her life based on their understanding of the Bible and Christianity is really quite different from the way a Protestant does it. And one of the easiest ways to see this is in terms of what the churches look like. Okay? So, for example, you know, in the Old Testament, right, there is this whole business about, and actually you see some of it in the New Testament as well, this concern about idols and icons. You know, that in other words, you shall not have graven images, right? That you shall not be worshiping things other than God directly. Okay? Now, this is an idea that the Protestants really ran with. And it's part of what often gets seen, you know, when the Protestants make their pitch that they're the real Christians, right? We talk about so-called primitive Christianity, right? The ultimate Christianity. Real Christianity. Christianity, you know, without the, you know, the sort of bells and whistles, but the real Christianity. Right, and that Christianity takes very seriously the idea that people need to have direct contact with God and that's taken very literally. That is one sense of literalism that definitely applies to all Protestants, regardless of whatever other views they have on biblical literalism. They believe that. Right, so as a result, what goes out the window from the standpoint? Well, you get rid of priests, you get rid of mediation generally, and you also get rid of the idea of worshiping statues and relics. You know, and fancy buildings that are designed in a way to conjure up experiences and imagery and in some way transform you sensorially. I mean, because that is in fact what the whole point of a lot of these very adorned churches and cathedrals that you see in Roman Catholicism and also in the Eastern Orthodoxy, right? Eastern Christian Church, which is very similar to Catholics in this regard, right? Very pro-icon, very pro-mediation. Okay, and so the idea here is that, you know, what you want to do if you're in this kind of more Catholic mode is you want a religion that that actually causes people to put in the mind, you know, to be mindful of God and to realize, you know, God's glory and majesty and significance and so forth. And that requires a kind of transformation of your consciousness. Right? It's not like being in a normal state of mind. So there's like, the Catholics, in a way, reinforce the idea that, in a sense, you know, part of us are kind of animal and the other part of us is like paying attention to God. And it's kind of bifurcated in a way. Whereas the Protestants want direct access to God. And direct access to God comes from having a clear mind, from thinking clearly, from deciding for oneself whether to believe, not to believe, all this kind of stuff, without mediation, without priests, without bells and whistles. Now, you see, you got these two very radical kind of views. So you think, you know, the extreme ways of thinking about this is, on the one hand, you know, all of the kind of grandiose ceremonies that are associated with the Catholic Church, where there's all this, you know, incense burning and all this Latin and all this kind of stuff, right, which really creates a kind of, you know, the religious world is radically different from the secular world, right, versus what you get in a more puritanical, low church forms of Protestantism, right, where basically, you know, the church is like a meeting hall, right, and people are talking, you know, about their secular lives and interspersing the Bible in that. And I think, you know, even with the forms of Protestantism that aren't so, you know, pared down and ascetic, if you watch, let's say, some of those televangelists on TV, if you ever get a chance to do that, it's very interesting, right? Because the whole point about these guys, right, is that they're basically saying God is in your life no matter how mundane it is. And they will get very mundane in what they talk about. They'll talk about God and you washing dishes. Right? This is a very Protestant kind of way of operating, right? And this is how they pull you in and really try to integrate the religion with your life. There's no difference. Okay? I'm saying all this because, in a way, that's how you can distinguish religions from each other in terms of the rituals, in terms of the ways in which they transform the way you are in the world. Right? So in a way, you wear your religion on your body, in your conduct, in your manner. So if you know anything about the history of Christianity, right, there's always been a big discussion about the way people should dress. Right, it still goes on today. Right, and if you think about it, you remember the Puritans, and you know, most of the Puritans got kicked out of this country and got sent to America, and you think about, you know, very kind of conservative dress, everybody in black, nobody wants to expose anything, people aren't allowed to dance. Right, that's the way in which you wear your religion on your body, right, in terms of your orientation to the world. Whereas that sort of thing wasn't allowed. You know, in Catholicism, people were drinking, getting drunk, you know, wearing flowery clothes, you know, engaged in sexual acts and all the rest of it. Okay, so there's a big difference there. Okay. But that is why it gets called religion, because it is a ritual. It's in terms of what you do, how you conduct your life. That's the main difference. Now you might think, well, wow, isn't there, can't you distinguish religions according to what people believe? Because so far, the kind of distinction I've been drawing between religions has to do with what people do, what they look like. In other words, something you could observe kind of behaviorally. You could tell one person from one religion from another by the way they conduct their lives. Okay? And I think from a sociological standpoint, that's the strongest way to do it. But sometimes people think that you can distinguish religions by what people believe. Okay? And is there anything in common that people of all religions believe? And you might say, well, people believe in God. Religious people believe in God. Well, this is not true. Right? It's certainly not true. I mean, if you think about God, at least in the sense in which we think about it in monotheistic religions, this is not certainly not true. Okay? And here's the big problem with the God issue. Okay? Because in monotheism, which is always the kind of anchor point for our discussions of religion, all the monotheistic religions do have a common conception of God. I think that's pretty fair to say. And it's a God who is transcendent, right? That is to say, a God who is in some sense separate from the world, separate from nature. Okay? Other features of this God is that this God, in some sense, has a special relationship to us, as opposed to all the other creatures on the planet which this God's responsible for. God has a special relationship to us. And a special relationship, not just, you know, not just in the sense that he likes us or something, but in some sense, this whole business of being created in the image and likeness of God. Okay, this creates, and this is really important, this aspect, because this is the aspect of religion that starts to feed into science is this aspect here I'm talking about. In Latin, there's this phrase, Imago Dei, which is image of God, right? And it comes from St. Augustine, who is usually regarded as the most profound of the church fathers. All the various Christians, pay homage to this guy, who was a bishop in northern Africa in the 4th century AD. And this is a period when Christianity is trying to get its act together and figure out what books of the Bible they ought to keep and so forth. So it's a period of consolidation. Augustine is right in the middle of all this. He's a guy who was originally trained in a very secular way in Rome and rhetoric and so forth, very learned guy, and then had this very famous conversion to Christianity that's detailed in his book, The Confessions, which is a very interesting book to read. And then after that, he becomes this great leader of the church. And he makes a big deal, and as subsequent Christians have, of Imago Dei, namely the idea that we are created in the image and likeness of God. Now, what follows from this, okay? Well, and this is where, and again, all the monotheistic religions are pretty much in agreement on this, is the idea that if we're in the image and likeness of God, okay, in some sense then, the universe or nature must be created in a way that we can make sense of it. That in a sense, you know, our minds kind of work like God's mind works. And that is the profound assumption, okay? Because in other religions, well, just about every religion has a kind of creative force. Whether it's personalized as a god or whatever, there's always a creative force, right? All religions give you a kind of story of how everything began, right? The creation myths. That's universal, right? The problem is with most of these creation myths, right, they're usually portrayed as irrational, right? It's kind of natural force that just comes out of nowhere and just puts it into being for no good reason, or it happens by accident, or, you know, all the stories tend to have that kind of quality. What they don't have is a sense that the way in which the world was created, right, is in some sense kind of like the way we create. So you read the Bible, right, you got, you know, God, like a potter, making sense out of mud, right, trying to get stuff into shape, and then you have God begetting things as if he was organically bringing beings into existence. I mean, the point is, that it all gets portrayed very much like God is a big person, big human. And not only that, God sort of defines human beings in these terms. So it's not just it's not just something in the literature itself, but it's something that it's in God's mouth to say this. So what this means then is that nature is what gets called intelligible. Now, I don't know, if you do any work in philosophy or the history of science, this word is a very important word, intelligible. What that means is that nature makes sense. It's rational. Right? It is tractable. It is open to our minds to make sense of it. See, we so much take for granted that science understands the world and all this, that we rarely ask the question, how did people ever come up with the idea that the world makes sense? Right, because it's one thing to say, I'm going to get by on a daily basis and, you know, make sense of my environment and try to stay out of trouble and live a decent life and then die. That's, in fact, the default position for most of humanity. But where do people come up with this idea that they can do a lot more than that? That they can, in some sense, understand how everything in the universe works. Right? And that not only can they understand it, they can, you know, come up with a few simple laws that can generate all the predictions and observations that will make sense of everything, especially the things that have no particular relevance to us, like, you know, stars billions of miles away. Now, who would ever come up with an idea? You know, why would people ever think such a thing? Why would they even find it in their interest to do this? Now, of course, what I'm talking about, you know, is science and primarily physics and, you know, Newton and Einstein and all these guys, right? This is what they think about. And the interesting thing about this, of course, is those sorts of accomplishments, those kinds of projects, are the things with which we typically identify as the pinnacle of human civilization, are those sorts of things. This attempt to understand the meaning of everything, coming in, you know, get it down to laws and reason and all that. That's what we typically, if some alien comes down and comes to Earth and say, okay, you humans, How do we know you're worth anything? You'd probably be pointing to Newton and Einstein, somebody like that. Okay? And so the question becomes, when do people, you know, why do people think this stuff? It's not obvious from an everyday standpoint that one should ever be thinking about these big questions. And this is where this kind of monotheistic thing becomes very important as a motivating factor. Because guys like Newton really did think he was getting into the mind of God. And this is something that you find very consistent in the history of science, at least until the recent past, where people, you know, in a sense, start to take very literally the idea that, okay, if we're creating the image and likeness of God, that means we can figure out everything God did. Right? In which case, let's do science. That's kind of how it went, okay? That's kind of basically how the transition from religion to science went. Now, of course, this causes a lot of problems for religion, because remember, religion is functioning in this kind of multi-purpose sociological capacity, right? So the church has to keep the peace, has to keep order, has to keep everybody, you know, behaving themselves and so forth. Meanwhile, there are a few people who also think of themselves as religious, who think they're going to get into the mind of God and perhaps come up with things that the church fathers aren't going to approve of. And those people could be potentially very destabilizing. Right? And that's where the religion-science conflict comes from. It comes from that point. See, look, if scientists were all atheists and didn't believe in God in the first place, there'd be no problem. Science would just be this thing on the side. Right? The problem comes because the people doing the science actually think they're doing God's work. Right? They're religious people. They're, you know, if you go to Newton's library in Cambridge, he was a fellow of King's College Cambridge, you will find that most of the books in his own library were books about theology, alchemy, astrology. This guy was obsessed. And he thought his physics was basically serving the purpose of interpreting what he believed was the kind of privilege that was offered to human beings through the Bible. That the Bible was basically telling us to figure out how the world worked. Okay? But this is very destabilizing. This is very destabilizing because religion, of course, is also trying to maintain order in society. And so Newton actually kept a lot of his own religious views very private. And in fact, it's because of the potential controversies that could be caused by connecting up religious belief with scientific belief that you started getting this kind of convention, which of course we respect very much today in scientific writing, where you justify scientific claims purely on scientific grounds. When the Royal Society got started in the 17th century, and Newton was one of the people who was involved in this, right? The Royal Society is the first scientific society in the world. This was happening in the midst, you know, right after the Civil War in this country. And as you know, the Civil War in this country in the 17th century, which led to Oliver Cromwell and all this, was a religious war. All these different Christians killing each other over how to read the Bible. Okay? That was basically what it was about. All right? And the Royal Society, which is the scientific society, basically said, my God, if we're going to make any progress in knowledge, we have to in some way draw a line between whatever religious beliefs people have that motivate them to do science from the actual science that they're presenting as being a valid understanding of the world. We have to draw that distinction. Otherwise, we're going to have people killing each other in the Royal Society. We're going to like reproduce these civil wars here. So the Royal Society basically established certain principles about the kinds of things that were allowed in and not allowed in. And so they specifically excluded politics, religion, rhetoric, metaphysics. They listed these things. It's in their charter. And what that meant was that if you were going to make a contribution, a scientific contribution, you had to be sure that you put it in these purely scientific terms. So it didn't make reference to God. Didn't make reference to particular interpretations of God or anything of that sort. But that didn't stop people from being motivated by religious issues. Okay. Now of course this science-religion problem, of course, rumbles on, as you know, through evolution and all the rest of it. And I'll be saying more about that later. But the point that I think is worth, you know, emphasizing is one reason why the science-religion split originates is that religion is doing a lot of work in society. Religion isn't just a way of knowing the world. religion is also a way of maintaining social order. And so it's the same people who are responsible for both, okay? See, nowadays, when you think about how science is pursued, scientists are their own professional community. They're relatively isolated from the rest of the world. There's no expectation that they have to toe a particular political or religious line when they're doing their work. They publish their work in these religiously and politically neutral terms in their professional journals. But before that got established, everything was under religion. And so that meant that particular scientific views that were religiously controversial could potentially destabilize society if they were given any kind of credence. And that explains why people like Galileo got persecuted, why guys like Newton did not reveal their religious views publicly, they kept them quiet. But that didn't mean they weren't there, and that didn't mean they didn't have any kind of force in motivating the way these people operate. It just meant that they didn't go public with it. Okay. And this issue still rumbles on today, as you know. Now, so this is the... Now, the monotheistic religions generally have had this kind of attitude towards science. So if you look at Islam, for example, people often don't realize this because in a way the peak of Muslim science was like in the 12th century, 13th century, a long time ago. People don't give it credit for what it actually did. But I think one thing you have to keep in mind is after the fall of Rome, okay, all of the various kinds of works of philosophers, poets, scientists, whatever, were dispersed throughout the Roman Empire, and there was a lot of wars taking place and a lot of difficulty in getting communication. And one of the things that happened quickly after Islam got founded in the 7th century AD was that the Arabs basically tried to collect all of the wisdom that was available in the European and Near East area and consolidated. Now why? This is an interesting question. Why do that? Especially given that the Quran is the sacred book, right? Well, the Quran says, among other things, you should understand. The Quran makes a statement very similar to what you get here. This Imago Dei thing is in the Quran as well. So that's one reason. But what's the point of gathering together all the secular knowledge? Because, in fact, I don't know if I've mentioned this here, but the classic ancient philosophical and scientific texts were written for the most part in Greek. But then, after the fall of Rome, they're dispersed in many different places. The Muslims gather all this stuff together, translate all of it into Arabic. And then, in the 13th century, okay, it gets translated into Latin, and it's that way that the Christians find out about it. Okay, so even though Christianity is an older religion than Islam, in terms of this kind of revival of knowledge, whereby you get back in touch with what was going on in the ancient world with Plato, Aristotle, Archimedes, all these people, that actually had to go through Muslim mediation. Okay, so you had this stuff originally in Greek, because remember the people in the Christian world were basically operating in Latin. And most of the ancient stuff wasn't written in Latin originally. It was written in Greek. And a lot of these people did not know Greek. They just knew Latin. Okay? The Muslims translate everything into Arabic. They write commentaries on everything. They expand some of the knowledge bases the Greeks had come up with. And then, in the 13th century, this stuff starts to get translated into Latin. And that's when you start to see Christian Europe taking off from an intellectual standpoint. Okay, so that's how history goes. And it's at that point that you start to have these discussions, which I think we're now familiar with in the West, of saying how do you reconcile sacred and secular knowledge? How do you reconcile the Bible on the one hand with Aristotle and later Galileo and so forth? Okay, that only arose as an issue because the Muslims thought that sacred secular knowledge needed to be consolidated in a unified body of knowledge. And the Christians inherited this problem. Okay. Now the interesting thing is why? Why have this idea in the first place? Because see, again, this is an idea that I think is very easy to take for granted, but actually required some invention. Namely, if you were, let's say, living in before the era of Christ, and you were traveling around the world as a kind of an intellectual, and you went to Greece or Rome, and you went to all these places sailing around the Mediterranean, Your attitude would probably have been that all the different philosophers and forms of knowledge that you encountered were very interesting, but they were basically valid just for where they were from. In other words, you would say, this is how Greeks think, this is how Romans think, this is how people, you know, in Palestine think, in Egypt, whatever. Right? That would have been your default attitude. Right? Always, and one of the ways you can see this is that you may know that the one of the earliest works of history in the West is by this guy, Herodotus. Have you heard of him? Herodotus? Have any of you ever run across this man's name? If anyone has, put their hands up. Just out of curiosity. Nobody. Okay. He's called the father of history. Herodotus is classic. His work is called Histories. And the interesting thing about this is that his attitude, and it's one that you see throughout the ancient world, is basically just cataloging different beliefs that people have in different places and making some comments about them. But all that he does is he relates the beliefs, no matter how sophisticated or interesting, to the people who have them. In other words, he's like a pure relativist in our terms. Right? You know about relativism, right? The idea that beliefs are valid just for a particular culture or society. Okay, Herodotus is a relativist. And that was, in fact, the default attitude in the ancient world. People were just relativists. You know this phrase, when in Rome do as the Romans do? That's an ancient phrase. That's kind of the way these people think. So then the question becomes, where do we get the idea that there are forms of knowledge that everyone ought to have, regardless of where they're from? That's the point, you see. And this idea is actually a religious idea, fundamentally. And it's associated with this practice that you start to see in Christianity, and especially in Islam, even before Christianity does this very much, is proselytism. You know what this is, proselytism? Have you ever run across this word? Proselytism is the active recruitment of people to the faith. Right? So you're advertising your religion and you're saying, it's for you. It's not just for me, it's for you too. You should convert. Right? You're trying to get people to convert to your religion, you're proselytizing. Okay? This is Christianity and Islam very distinctive in this regard. Most world religions do not proselytize. Right? The Buddhists are there in their temple. You know where they are. They'll be happy to receive you if you want to come, but they're not going to be knocking on your door and saying, become a Buddhist. This is Christianity and Islam. These are the people who actually recruit people. Now, why do they do this? Are they just being obnoxious or something? No, it's because they believe there is universal knowledge. And if knowledge is universal, then everyone's got to have it. And the fact that you don't have it means you're deprived. Okay? Now, I mentioned this point about proselytism because this is an attitude toward knowledge that science inherits. Think about science. Think about the way Richard Dawkins operates. Right? If you don't believe in evolution, you're deprived, man. Think about the rhetoric of scientists. Right? It's very much like, this knowledge is for everyone. And if you don't have this knowledge, you are deprived. You are irrational. You are suffering. A sub-modern fate. Right? Science is exactly the same way as these proselytizers in religion are. And it's not by accident because it's basically the same people doing it. I mean, in a sense, like I was saying, the whole scientific attitude comes from the monotheistic religions. And it's from and what this leads you to is the idea that there is a kind of universal knowledge that all of us are entitled to by virtue of having been created in the image and likeness of God. So all human beings, we're all children of the same God, we ought to have the same knowledge. Now this then motivates the Muslims, once they start getting going, okay, to put together all the knowledge that's available in the ancient world into a neat package, all in Arabic, which is, you know, Arabic, as you know, was originally a trade language. It wasn't the language of particular, you know, culturally specific people, but rather was a trade language across many different cultures, okay? And to put all of that stuff in that one language, one neat package with commentary, and then basically push it. you know, under the umbrella of Islam. Right? Because, as you know from the Quran, Islam is the crowning achievement of this trajectory that goes from Judaism through Christianity. Islam's the final point, and all the science that is there in the world ought to be under it. And that's in fact what the whole, and that was the way in which it operated. So if you were to go to the major centers of Muslim knowledge in the Middle Ages, so Baghdad in the east, and Cordoba in Spain, in the west, those were kind of the boundary points, that's where the main centers of activity were in the Middle Ages in the Muslim world, you will see, you know, incredible amount of scientific activity, you know, observations being taken, you know, all kinds of technologies being developed, very sophisticated stuff, all under the name of Islam. Okay? And so, when you get these people nowadays talking about Islamic science and so forth, they're not just making stuff up here. There's a sense in which the whole idea that there's a unified body of knowledge called science that has universal purchase was the kind of idea that Islam was really the first one to promote, because it brought together all these different sources under a unified language and interpretive scheme. And this was the thing that the Christians then picked up on and ran with tremendously. And by the way, you know, as you know, the 13th century, what are we talking about here, going on here? We're talking Crusades, right? So there is this Cold War, you might say, ongoing. You want to think about it kind of in modern terms. You know, that in a sense, Christendom and Islam were a bit like, you know, the U.S. and the USSR during the Cold War. There is this ongoing tension, but also exchange taking place. And there are always these Crusades who are popping up every so many years. And it was in this context that the Christians believed they had to smarten up their act and actually pick up on what these Muslims were doing. And so the people who really kind of go to town with this, Thomas Aquinas, you may have heard of him, he's the great doctor of the Catholic Church. Thomas Aquinas, if you read his works, not that they're so exciting, but, he is a man who basically answers point for point for point everything that he found in the Muslim commentaries of the stuff that had been translated from Arabic to Latin. So he has this thing called Summa Theologica, right, the summary of theology. And what that book is basically just a point-by-point argument against everything the Muslim commentators say. Because what the Muslim commentators say is, you know, they'll talk about Plato and Aristotle and Archimedes, and they'll talk about all the forms of knowledge the ancients have, and they will, of course, give it a Muslim spin. Right? So the kind of view of God that's presupposed will be kind of like the theologically acceptable view in Islam, right? It'll be spun that way. And so what Aquinas does is, he re-spins it a Christian way. I mean, that's kind of what goes on, right? And that then becomes sort of church doctrine, you know, into the time of Galileo. So when Galileo is being hauled in by the Inquisition in the 17th century, right, they're holding him accountable basically to views of Thomas Aquinas. Okay? So this is how the history goes on this. But the thing that's so interesting is that when we start to talk about this history, we're talking about a history where everybody's presupposing there is universal knowledge. There is knowledge that all of us ought to have. And then the question becomes, well, what should that knowledge be? Right? And this is where, you know, Aquinas has all his arguments with the Muslim commentators. Okay? Because there's, you know, it's not a matter of let bygones be bygones. You Christians, you believe what you want. You Muslims, you believe what you want. No, it's not like that at all, is it? No, it's rather one of them's right. Because we're talking universal knowledge here. We're not just talking culturally relative knowledge, we're talking universal knowledge, knowledge for everyone. So in a sense, part of the arguments that somebody like Thomas Aquinas and all these great church philosophers had, right, against Islam, it's almost an argument of conversion, right? Namely, yeah, you Muslims think you have the best line on all these ancient guys, and this is the reason why we ought to be Muslim, but in fact, the Christians have a better line on this. Okay, so this is the way this whole thing was thought about, universal knowledge, okay? And it's when you start to move into this frame that religion isn't just a kind of lifestyle for a particular culture in a particular place, but is rather a calling for everyone to kind of believe and behave in the same ways, then you start to move from religion into a domain that looks like science, where you start to talk about whether people are rational or irrational. Right? When we, you know, again, think Richard Dawkins, right? Think of these kind of very totalizing ways in which he sees the world, which in a way is a very extreme version of the scientific worldview. Those attitudes are attitudes that are inherited from the monotheistic religions. Okay? And this is where it's interesting to look at all the other things that get called religions. Because if you look at, for example, something like Confucianism in China, right, which for many years was a kind of official religion, right, Confucianism doesn't make any grand claims about what human beings can understand. I mean, in fact, it's very similar to what you see in most of the other Asian religions, which is the idea that human beings aren't about, in some sense, realizing some divine plan. That's not what human beings are about. Human beings are about acquiring a certain kind of wisdom to cope with the world as it is. This is a very important point, okay? And this goes to a distinction that was made in the 19th century that I think remains very profound for sorting out religions. The difference between prophetic and wisdom-based religions. The monotheistic religions are prophetic religions. They are always directing you to the future. Right? In other words, what is this religion about? What are these religions about? They are about transforming yourself, becoming closer to God. Maybe even becoming God in some of the more heretical forms. Right? There's a sense in which we have to extricate ourselves from our animal being, which is the product of original sin or something. And we have to then move into this higher space where we become more profound and deeper and more godlike. Right, that is the trajectory, that's a prophetic religion. They're basically pushing us into the future and kind of painting us this picture, you know, of life in heaven and stuff like that. And where heaven happens to be, that's an open question. Is it on earth? Is it out there? Who knows? But the point is, it's basically trying to tell human beings they have to push themselves out from where they are. And in a sense, nature is the enemy of the human in the monotheistic religions, right? Because it's what pulls us down. Our mortality, our animality, all those kinds of things. The wisdom religions are radically different, right? So if you look at Buddhism and Hinduism, Confucianism, Taoism, all these things, the message of those religions is you've got to adapt, you've got to cope. You've got to realize your limitations, you've got to respect nature. You've got to learn to fit in the world. Don't stress. Right? These are very meditative religions. Okay? This is a big difference, a very big difference. Now, alongside of all of the, you know, the wisdom religions, not surprisingly, tend to be religions where if there is a God that in some sense transcends nature, and most of them don't have such a God, for most of them, if there's, well, God is just a force of nature. It's not something that transcends nature, but it's a force of nature. But in any case, God, or whatever, the creative force, is typically inscrutable in the wisdom religions. In other words, there is no promise in the wisdom religions of you somehow getting ahead of the game. In other words, there is no way for you to figure out how the world works so that you can manipulate it to your advantage. Okay? That isn't the message. The message is you've got to learn how to be in the world. And that is a process of self-discovery, realizing your limitations. And that part of what you do going through this process is you purge yourself of lots of illusions you might have. Like, for example, that you might be God, right? Which then would tend to make you do things that in the end just makes everybody miserable. That's the other thing, too. The wisdom religions, at the end of the day, their line is, we should try to minimize suffering, right? We're trying to cope. We're trying to minimize suffering. We don't want to cause more problems than we need to. And so it becomes important that we are in balance with nature. Now, you can see how this whole way of thinking, right, would lend itself very much to this kind of ecological perspectives that are very popular now. Right? Because there's a sense in which when you diagnose the problems that are taking place in the physical environment, it's very easy to say, well, the reason why we've got global warming and all these tremendous problems is because human beings thought they were a lot smarter than they really are. Right? They overextended themselves. They thought they could conquer the world. They thought they were gods. And look what's happened. We're screwing over the planet, and we're all going to die if we don't stop. You see, this is where the wisdom religions kick in. Because basically the wisdom religions are telling you that all along. Okay? So, for example, 35 years ago, there was an Austrian who was he's an Austrian economist, but he was working in this country in the coal board by the name of Fritz Schumacher. Have any of you ever heard of him? E.F. Schumacher, economist? He wrote the book, Small is Beautiful. You ever heard of that book, Small is Beautiful? Introduction to Buddhist Economics. Buddhist Economics. And this man is the wisdom business. And this was 35 years ago. Now I don't know if you not even you're 35, that's a problem. 1973, okay, there was this oil embargo around the world, right? What that meant was that, you know, the price of oil went enormously high. It was basically a cartel of all the oil-producing countries decided they were going to bring the West to their knees by raising the price of oil that was going to then, make life difficult for the rest of us. And it was at that point that people began to say, my God, we're just too dependent on oil, right? And the oil's running out, and it can be subject to these kind of treacherous embargoes. We need new ways of coping with the world so that we don't have to rely on so many resources. And so this guy Schumacher wrote this book in the wake of all this. It was a very important book, very popular book. It still resonates with a lot of people today about scaling down your use of the environment, your use of material resources, getting by with less, actually working with smaller social units, you know, in a way very much like what the anarchists often talk about, right? Get rid of the state, have smaller mutual aid societies, all this kind of stuff. This guy Schumacher was into all that. And he gives you kind of an economic framework for thinking about it. It's called Buddhist economics. Okay? And this is a great example of this sort of wisdom approach. Okay? That he was promoting. And so, both religious attitudes still have a lot of purchase today in quite different ways. And they are complementary, you might say, right? That the prophetic religions kind of cater to a certain kind of view about human beings, you know, very ambitious, progressive view, whereas the wisdom religions cater to a much more moderate kind of precautionary kind of view of human beings as being one with the world. Okay, and so these two views are very much part of religion, but not in any way that clearly distinguishes religion from other aspects of society. They're more like generalized worldviews, right, that you can apply in many different kinds of settings. Okay? All right, well, I'll stop here because we're getting close to the hour, and I will resume next time, and I will begin in the discussion of science. I will start by talking about evolution and then move to this broader discussion about how science becomes a kind of social movement in its own right, in a way kind of like I was talking about with Dawkins just now.